afternoon. You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon for Friday, March 20th, year 2015. Jeff Brown here on the show. Today we'll talk with author Jeff Chang about his talk on Monday night at UAS. We'll talk with author and walker Mary Lou King about her book, Nighty Short Walks Around Juno. Bob Armstrong will be here with a preview of his Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center happening tonight. And we'll talk with members of Buddy Boxes about their Saturday performance for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. The forecast for tonight, rain, low temperatures around 36 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, rain. Forecast for Sunday, partly cloudy skies in the morning, beginning Sunday.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native mushers are among participants in the Iditarod sled dog race in Alaska. As KYUK's Daisha Eaton tells us, two native mushers from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have crossed the finish line.
Yupik musher Pete Kaiser of Bethel was 14th to cross the finish line of the 2015 Iditarod in Nome Thursday morning at 1:44 a.m. Kaiser said it was a windy and challenging race.
Kind of a frustrating one, but I think that's how most of them end up going probably, and kind of just feels good to get here right now.
Alaska Natives have used their husky dogs to pull sleds for work and sport since time immemorial. The Iditarod sled dog race started in 1973 to bring back the waning tradition of mushing dogs as they were being replaced by snow machines. Kaiser won the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race in Bethel earlier this year. This was his sixth Iditarod. He finished Iditarod 2015 with 11 dogs. His total race time was 9 days, 15 hours, 44 minutes, and 35 seconds. He brings home $21,700 in prize money. Athabaskan Richie Deal of Aniak placed 23rd, crossing under the Burled Arch in Nome at 9:26 a.m. Deal's total race time was 9 days, 23 hours, 26 minutes and 59 seconds. About his dogs, he said,
I think it definitely took them a little adjusting, you know, to the cold out there because we haven't seen it in a while, but once they got used to it, they're doing fantastic.
Deal finished with 10 dogs and earned $9,000 in prize money. This was his third Iditarod. Dallas CV won this year's race, crossing the finish line in Nome at 4:13 a.m. Wednesday. The race was moved from Anchorage to Fairbanks this year due to lack of snow and warm temperatures. 79 mushers started the race, 9 scratched, and 1 was disqualified. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The state high school girls basketball tournament in South Dakota has wrapped up. School festivities include the performance of a song to honor veterans. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more on the Lakota Flag Song.
In quiet arenas around the state, singers offer the song in tribute to servicemen and women. Jess Mendoza is head girls basketball coach at state girls qualifier Cheyenne Eagle Butte.
Well, I think it's an honor for our people to sing that, you know, since they've served in the armed services. And so we do a lot as a member of the board of directors for the Lakota Nation Invitational. That's all part of how we honor our veterans, not only our Native American, but all veterans.
There's a certain criteria that must be met to have the song performed at a state-sanctioned game or event. John Krogstrand is with the South Dakota High School Activities Association.
Really, it comes down to if there's a school that has Native American heritage or population, they have the option to be able to perform that song. They have their responsibility to bring their own performer to have learned it and to be able to sing it in their native language and things, but ultimately we offer them that opportunity.
Ellis Chips of Pine Ridge is credited with writing the anthem in the 1950s. While it takes about 2 minutes to perform, its translation to English consists of 16 words. The president's flag will stand forever. Under it, the people grow, so I do this. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
The Navajo Nation reports a tribal police officer was killed Thursday in the line of duty. A shooting occurred when police responded to a domestic violence call. The suspect shot two officers. One died at the scene. The other was taken to a hospital. After a manhunt, the suspect was later shot to death in the community of Red Valley in Arizona. Names were not released Thursday as the tribe is expected to release further details. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our guest at the start of the show is Jeff Chang. He's doing a talk at Monday night at the University of Alaska Southeast, and he's calling from California. Jeff, thanks for being on the air with me today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So you're an author, and are you a performer? You do classical hip hop?
I'm actually not a performer. I look at my primary craft as writing.
Your book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, chronicled the early hip-hop scene. What is it about hip-hop that solidifies its place in music history?
Well, you know, I think hip-hop really, in a lot of respects, reflected on the past histories of black music and pulled it all together in sort of a new sound, you know, beginning in the 70s, moving through the 80s and the 90s and all the way out through now. To express the voice of young people and the, you know, the sort of broad desires and hopes and dreams and ambitions and feelings of young people all around the world. And so for me, you know, it's been something that's deeply, dramatically impacted my life, but I feel like it's also impacted millions of other people just like me. And now it's been generations. It's been multiple generations. I can have conversations with my teenage kids, you know, about the latest artists and find out, you know, what's on their minds, what's on their generation's minds through hip-hop.
Could you elaborate a little bit about the impact of hip-hop music and social change?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to me, again, you know, hip-hop has been sort of, to me, the most important social movement globally. Of my generation, certainly of the last quarter, probably of the 20th century, and I think it still holds a lot of weight now amongst young people. It's a thing that completely evolves. It turns over, completely changes over every 3 years, and so older folks like me, you know, might be like, well, that's not the hip hop that I grew up with, but that's not the point. The point is that young people are taking it and changing it and making it fit their voices and their feelings, you know, at any given type of moment. And so, you know, to me, hip-hop has been something that's been a voice for change. It's also been a voice against change, but I've seen hip-hop used in youth uprisings and sort of political movements and social movements and cultural movements, you know, for decades now that guide young people rising up against police brutality or rising up against unfair authoritarian rule or, you know, just the conditions that folks face economically, socially, culturally, racially, gender-wise even in this society. Hip-hop is a voice for them to be able to express their feelings about those kinds of questions and issues.
If one were to Google hip-hop music, what individuals or groups would come out near the top of the rankings?
Well, you know, I think, you know, the big commercial artists would probably, you know, be folks like Kanye West and Jay-Z. But that's not all of it. You know, I think that hip-hop is a kind of cultural movement that's fluid and it's impacted all kinds of forms of art. So in the old days, people used to talk about the four elements of hip-hop, right? They used to talk about emceeing, DJing, right? Breaking and graffiti art, and what we've seen is that there's been a fifth element that's been added to that, and that's knowledge, knowledge of self, knowledge of one's history, knowledge of the struggle, and in addition to that, I think people have taken hip-hop into all kinds of different realms. So you see hip-hop theater now, you see spoken word poetry, you see hip-hop visual art in the galleries, you see street art, you know, you see hip-hop, literature, hip-hop nonfiction writing, which is sort of what I do. And it sort of has expanded to kind of embrace all the kinds of different forms of art and creativity that people can use to express. And so it's not just about the commercial rap artists and stars. I think it's about these grassroots movements of creative folks, you know, using hip-hop as a way to be able to express themselves.
I've noticed there's even a hip opera.
What's that?
There's even a hip opera.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. There's hip operas. There's hip hop movies. There's, you know, hip hops in the galleries, and there's hip hop fashion. Of course, there's hip hop. You know, everything. Everything's hip hop. There's hip hop diners now. You know what I mean? There's hip hop food. People like Eddie Huang make what they, you know, kind of frame as hip hop food. So. So it's kind of become something that's ubiquitous. It's everywhere.
On your website, you talk about the selling of multiculturalism.
Yeah, and you know, here's the thing: is that hip hop, you know, started off as an underground movement. It started as something that was put together by black and brown kids in the Bronx. They were forgotten kids. People didn't look out for them. People didn't think much of them. You know, government pulled out money from the Bronx. There were social programs that were collapsing. You know, they lived in neighborhoods that were run down, and yet the hip hop became their form of creativity. You know, so hip hop kind of rose up from these kinds of backgrounds. And I think what you see by the 80s and the 90s, especially in the 1990s, is it becomes a lot more commercialized and dispersed. And there's a feeling that hip hop doesn't necessarily have the same kind of feeling to it, the same kind of edge to it, the same kind of drive and sort of resistance, you know, to it that was there before. And so hip hop has changed a lot, I think, you know. And what I try to uphold is that hip hop is still at the grassroots level. You know, it's everywhere. It's on the res. It's you know, in the borderlands. It's, you know, in the neighborhoods and the barrios, and it's something that's allowing people to be able to express themselves. That's the kind of hip hop that I'm really most interested in. I'm actually less interested in the stuff that's selling millions and millions and generating all kinds of, you know, profits for folks very far away. I'm really interested in what's happening right here on my block and what's happening in other people's blocks all around the world.
I'm talking with Jeff Chang. He's talking Monday night at the University of Alaska Southeast. One of the things you're going to be talking about is the colorization of America. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. So, you know, I've been really interested in seeing how the U.S. has changed over the last half century. And there's been a lot of demographic shifts. You know, we live now in a society that is moving towards becoming a quote-unquote majority-minority. And so that's what I call the colorization of America. You know, is there's been these massive demographic shifts that have occurred, but along with that have come a lot of cultural shifts. And with those cultural shifts, you know, it hasn't been easy. There's been a lot of backlash, I think, coming from people who want a more homogenous kind of country and nation, who don't accept necessarily the cultural change that's happening and all the kinds of ways that different people who are being recognized now in the American public, you know, transform and change and expand what it means to be American. There's a lot of people that don't like that. And so my book, you know, talks a lot about the colorization of America. It talks a lot about this process of change and how it hasn't been an easy road. And I'm really interested now in, you know, in the wake of these sort of high profile of Alec Ferguson in New York City, all around the country, really. I'm really interested, how is it to get to a place where we're able to see each other really in our own, you know, full humanity, so that we can get to a place where we can live together. I'm really interested in that, and that's what I think the colorization of America is really about, is finding new ways of living together, you know, beyond homogeneity, beyond sort of this one way of being American.
Sounds like your talk on Monday night is going to be Hip Hop 101.
It's going to be, I think, Hip Hop 101, but it's also going to be a lot about where we're at right now, I think, you know, in respect to the question of race, which I think is like, you know, a lot of people in this country look at it now as one of the most important issues behind the economy to for us to be addressing. And 4 in 10 Americans actually believe that there's more racial division now than there was at the beginning of President Obama's administration, which is it's very sad. You know, Obama framed himself and his candidacy as being one of reconciling these divisions, and instead we see even more divisions than ever before. So I'm interested in kind of the role that culture plays in helping to bring us together, the way that hip-hop brought us together, and then the ways that people use culture to keep us apart, and how do we move beyond that? How do we move towards this sort of new society that we can move towards?
What's your next project you're working on?
Well, I have a bunch of different books under contract. One of them is going to be a book of essays on youth, and the other is going to be a biography of Bruce Lee, one of my heroes, big heroes, and I know a lot of people's heroes.
I've been talking with Jeff Chang. He's talking Monday night at the University of Alaska Southeast. Jeff, is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to have a really interesting discussion this coming week.
All right, thanks a lot.
Take care of yourself.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 20th of March, 2015, first day of spring, the vernal equinox, the Earth's axis aligned with the center of the sun. It's the birthday of the Roman poet Ovid, born in Sulmo, Italy, in 43 BC, beloved poet in Rome for his Ars Amatoria, his erotic poems, and his Metamorphoses. And then in 8 AD, he was exiled. He had seen something, evidently, that the emperor did not want him to see, and he was sent away from his beloved Rome and died in exile. It's the birthday of the playwright Henrik Ibsen, born in Skien, Norway, 1828. He was 18 when he fathered a son with a servant. He had to pay child support. He turned 20. He owned absolutely nothing. He ran a theater in Bergen and then was artistic director of another theater in Oslo, got married, had a son. Family was very poor. He was regularly sued for debt. 1862, he lost his job. He drank heavily. And then in 1863, the government gave him a travel grant, and the Ibsen family left for Italy. And he didn't come back to Norway for 27 years. They settled in a little village near Rome. Ibsen went to work. He wrote a long play in verse, Brand, which made him famous in 1865, followed it up with Peer Gynt, even more successful, wrote A Doll's House, The Enemy of the People, The Wild Duck, and Hedda Gabler. It was on this day, 1854, the Republican Party was founded by anti-slavery opponents of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The party did well in the North, had no following in the South, and its first successful candidate for president, of course, was Abraham Lincoln in 1860. It's the birthday of the psychologist B.F. Skinner, born in Susquehanna, Pennsylvania, 1904, a leading exponent of the school of psychology known as behaviorism, which explains the behavior of humans and animals in terms of their psychological responses to external stimuli. Skinner did a lot of research with animals, mainly rats and pigeons, and invented the famous Skinner box, in which a rat learns to press a lever in order to obtain food. And it's the birthday of Fred Rogers, born in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, 1928, host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, seen across the country from 1968 until the year 2000. Began with Rogers singing It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, changing into his sneakers and a cardigan, which he talked to children about feeling good about yourself, getting along with others, and handling your own fears. Here's a poem for today by Linda Gregg, Bamboo and a Bird. In the subway, late at night, waiting for the downtown train at 42nd Street, walking back and forth on the platform, too tired to give money, staring at the magazine covers in the kiosk. Someone passes me from behind, wearing an orange vest and dragging a black hose. A car stops, and the doors open. All the faces are plain. It makes me happy to be among these people who leave empty seats between each other. Bamboo and a Bird, a poem by Linda Gregg from In the Middle Distance, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
I can't believe they posted these pictures online. That's horrible. We need to do something.
I don't think we should get involved.
Have you seen these? We have to do something.
Maybe you're right.
Can I talk to you?
Every Alaskan has the right to be safe and free from domestic violence and sexual assault.
Together we can make a difference. Visit dps.alaska.gov/CDVSA.
It's 22 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. In the studio with me now is Mary Lou King, who's famous around Juno for lots of things. She's written a book about the Last Chance Mining Museum, Perseverance Trail, the Treadwell Mine Historic Trail, a book on nature detectives. But the one that she's most famous for is a book called 90 Short Walks Around Juno. And now it's been updated several times, so now it's 90 Short Walks Plus Around Juno. Mary Lou, thank you very much for coming in today.
You're welcome.
So what drew you to Alaska?
Oh, I'd been teaching school in Oregon, and I decided I need to have some adventure in my life, and I'm still having an adventure.
What caused you to write this book, 90 Short Walks Around Juno?
I helped start and then coordinated the Sea Week program in the schools while my children in school. And in doing that, I thought it was important to spread the classes out so that they aren't all at one beach, so that it doesn't destroy the wildlife in the beaches. And so I came to the borough and I found out where the public access places were around close to town. And then our son James, when he was in high school, helped put up the signs and fix these trails. And I wrote them all up. And the Forest Service was going to put them in the hiking book, but when it came time for their hiking book, they didn't have time for them, so I did my own book.
It's been well received. What year did it first come out?
1988.
And how many times has it been updated?
Well, many times, just a little bit, but the last two times are with the nice cover, and the last one is this one that's last year, 2014.
I imagine the most common question you get asked is, have you walked them all?
I've never hiked the ridge back behind town, and I've never been clear to the top of Mount Juno, but I've been on all the rest.
The book is more than 90 trails now.
Somebody counted them and said there were 140.
It's amazing. What are your favorite trails?
The one I'm on.
Want to tell me about some of the other books you wrote? I'm looking at this one. Nature Detectives on Our Favorite Trails.
My granddaughter and I put that together, and it's the Out of Point Trail, but it can be used in any Southeast trails. And what it has in it, Kathy Connor helped us identify the pebbles on the beach, and so they're in there, and the trees along the trail are identified. And so it's a really nice little book to take school classes and things on, because they can learn not only the plants but the animals and the stones on the beach and the intertidal life, all on this one nifty trail.
One of the things you're working on is spruce root basketry.
That's right. I really like to weave with spruce roots, and I was taught by Selena Pradovich many, many years ago how to go harvest the roots, how to take the bark off, how to then split them and fix them up, and then weave them into baskets, and I really like doing that.
You're partially, if not fully, responsible for some handouts that they give away at any museum and sell at the City Museum. One is called the Treadwell Mine Historic Trail Walking Tour and Perseverance Theater, or Perseverance Trail, in the Last Chance Mining Museum. How did these books come about?
Well, because in 90 Short Walks, well, I do have a little history and various things in there, but there's so much more history in this town of the mining era, and then there's also history which I didn't have access and didn't get into, but I think somebody, it would be nice if there was a history of the native people, because they were the most successful, beautiful basket weavers and success in life of anybody. And I think many people could benefit from learning about how they could be such wonderful people way back before a white man got here with his knives and things.
And tell me about your property that you have the bird sanctuary at.
And what about what?
The bird sanctuary at your house.
Well, my husband, Jim, had the daydream to get a refuge going there. And then a lot of people participated in that. So that's a state refuge, and we live right on the edge of it. And then we kept injured birds for many years and raised a lot of birds there, like geese and swans and ducks. And it's a wonderful place to live right there on the edge of the Mendenhall Tide Flats.
You must get thanked constantly for the amount of work you put in and the amount of time you save people to go on good trails versus bad trails. Have you talked to anybody who's actually done them all?
No, some people say they have, but I don't know if they have.
Now, you said whatever trail you're on is your favorite trail. Do you have maybe a top five that you might recommend to people who are asking?
Well, Outer Point is really great because it has not only this wonderful old-growth forest with huge spruce trees, then it has a muskeg, it has a beaver dam area, then it has the beach that has fantastic intertidal life on it. And you have all these things on one trail, a short trail.
What are your recommendations for kind of things that people should bring with them when they're hiking on trails?
Well, it depends on if they 90 short walks first. And then, if it's raining, they need their boots and the raincoat, and they just need to have their eye open when they're hiking and recognize when they need to head back home.
How often do you get out hiking?
How often? Well, I used to lots and lots, but I still go out quite a bit on the short trails around Juneau.
I noticed your book is called 90 Plus Short Walks Around Juneau. How come it's not called Trails?
Well, because it was started for this beach access, which are just the short ones, the ways to get to the beach. And so they were walks. And then it just grew.
Tell me what you feel when you're walking outside. What kind of changes it makes it with you, in you spiritually?
Oh, it just makes me feel really good to be out there and to see the things of nature that, and the beauty, and even just the littlest things like the shape of a spruce cone, for instance, and I've spent a lot of time with children, with students out there, and you know, some people walk down a trail and never see anything around them, but to get kids to start thinking about the variety of things you can see when you hike on a trail.
Well, you can get some of these pamphlets at the City Museum, I know, but where can you get your books?
Well, they have them at Hearthside, and they have them at the top of the tram, and I think all the bookstores in town now have them.
I think they're top sellers.
Somebody told me that I sold more books than Bob Armstrong.
That's a tough thing to do.
That is a really tough thing to do, considering the fact that it's only a hiking book. And the things he's done are just fantastic, aren't they?
And we're going to be talking to him next.
Good.
Mary Lou King, thanks so much for coming down to the station today and talking about your work and about your short walks around Juneau book.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
This is Bird Note. One of the magical gifts of spring is to hear the dawn song. As early morning light extinguishes the stars, as the first rays of sunlight fill the trees, male birds begin to pour out their songs. Warblers, sparrows, chickadees, thrushes, finches, wrens, blackbirds. While the awe and majesty of this symphony at dawn are hard to convey, poet Emily Dickinson described it this way. The birds begun at 4 o'clock, their period for dawn, a music numerous as space and measureless as noon. I could not count their force. Their voices did expend as brook by brook bestows itself to magnify the pond. Their witnesses were not, except occasional man in homely industry arrayed to overtake the morn. Nor was it for applause that I could ascertain, but independent ecstasy of deity in men. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
It's 33 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a Juneau afternoon here on Monday, the 20th of March, the year 2015. In the studio with me now is Bob Armstrong. Well, now we can find out if Bob Armstrong sells more copies than Mary Lou King of your book.
I doubt I have. I may have written more books than Mary Lou King, but individual books, I doubt they've sold more copies than what she has. That's a wonderful book on hiking in Juneau.
Bob, you're talking tonight at the Fireside Lecture at the Mininauk Glacier Visitor Center. Talking about photography, I imagine.
Using a lot of video clips and how different things are related and connected in nature and... It'll be kind of similar to the Audubon meeting, but there'll be a lot different videos shown, and then I'll also show how to connect different video clips together to tell a story.
What's so special about video compared to still photography?
The thing I enjoy about it is you often see things that you can't see by taking a still photograph. One prime example of I was taking a video of a red squirrel taking seeds out of a spruce cone, and he does it pretty fast, and I thought it was a one-step process. He'd just take the seed out and eat it. But when I took a video of it and slowed it way down, I could see he was taking two steps. He would take the seed out, and then he'd put the seed has a coating on it, and he'd put it on the flat part of the cone, and then take the coating off before eating the seed. And I never would have known that if I hadn't taken a video of it.
Are there any animals out there that are natural hams?
That are natural hams? I thought the squirrel was because he was a side view, and then when he saw me taking a video of him, he turned and faced me, and as if to say, this is how I do it, and that was pretty cute.
What else are you going to be talking about tonight?
The one fairly long video for a video is maybe 5 minutes long, and it's I titled it Salmon and Blowflies, and it shows all the connections that go along when bears take salmon from a stream, and then once they're satiated, they often go just for the female salmon to go for the eggs, and when they're done, they leave the carcasses around, and then these flies come and lay their eggs in the carcasses. And the common fly that comes is called a blowfly, and that produces all the larvae, or what we normally call maggots, that eat the and finish off the salmon carcass. Well, this provides tremendous amounts of nutrients to the stream, which is real important for salmon young and so on. But what I've discovered is that a lot of birds come to feed on these maggots. And so far I've documented about 12 different species of birds, and all of them are juveniles. And so it happens at a time when birds are fledging, and juveniles are fairly inefficient at finding food. So I think maggots provide a wonderful source of food for them.
What kind of gear do you use to take a video with?
I have two types. One I've been experimenting with for about the last year that I really like for underwater photography, and that's just the simple GoPro camera. And they're very...
You just stick the camera in the water?
Yes. It has a waterproof housing. And the video will last for about a little over 3 hours. And it does an incredible clear job underwater. And you can see things happening that you can't see by looking down into the water.
And where's a good place to go for people who want to...
Clear streams are the best. Schweitzer Creek is good. Sheep Creek is good, and Steep Creek. Those three are probably the clearest streams in Juneau. And the Schweitzer Creek is particularly interesting because it's mostly spring-fed. And so a lot of fish concentrate in winter around the springs, and that's fun to watch. And it stays open all winter, so you can do a lot of photography in winter that you can't. In a normal winter, a normal Juneau winter, you can't in Juneau.
I'm interested and fascinated about putting a camera in the water. Do you use any, is there a tripod you're using, or you just kind of dunk it in there?
Well, thanks to Doug Jones, who we've been kind of developing these techniques together, he discovered just a flat diving weight. Like a 2 pound or 3 pound weight, and you strap the GoPro to the weight, and then that gives you a very firm place to put it on the bottom, and it stays, except some salmon hit it accidentally and knock it over. But
do you remember your first still camera?
The best one I like is one of the cheaper ones, the Panasonic FC200. There are a couple reasons that I really like it. One, if I want to take a video with it, it'll last for 3 hours on the battery, and where most of the DSLRs and stuff shut down after about 25 minutes or so. Another advantage of the Panasonic is it's got a much higher depth of field for really close-up stuff. And you can attach a lens called a super macro lens to the end of it. So you can full frame like a mosquito or something only 1 to 2 millimeters long. And so it gives you an opportunity to take both still photos and videos of things that would be very difficult to get otherwise. And you can handhold it.
Well, Mark Armstrong, you're talking tonight at the Menlo Glacier Visitor Center Friday Fireside Lecture, 6:30 and then 8 o'clock. This is both happening, and they're both free. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, I'm trying to make it as interesting as possible. And one thing I might add is that on my website, which is Nature Bob, I've got close to about 3,500 photographs and over 100 videos, and those are all free for educational and conservation purposes. So any teacher that wants to use any of them in a classroom or anyone who wants to use it for education or conservation is welcome to just download them from the website.
What kind of hints do you have to give to people who want to take nature photography?
The best thing is to let creatures come to you. Don't chase them. You get the most interesting photographs that way, sitting and waiting. If you want to photograph beavers, get up at 4 a.m. in the morning and sit next to a pond and wait.
All right, Bob, thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Moving in silent desperation, keeping an eye on the Holy Land. A hypothetical destination. Say, who is this walking man? Well, the leaves have come to turn in, and the goose has gone to fly, and bridges are for burning, so don't you let that yearning pass you by. Walking man walks, well, any other man stops and talks, but the walking man walks. Is on the pumpkin, and the hay is in the barn, yeah. And Pappy's come to rambling off, stumbling around, drunk down on the farm. And the walking man walks, he doesn't know nothing at all. Any other man stops and talks, but the walking man walks on by, walk on by. Most everybody got seeds to sow. It ain't always easy for a weed to grow. No, no, he don't hold the rope. No one, sure one's always missing, and something is never quite right. Ah, but who would want to listen to you kissing his existence goodnight? Walking man, walk on by my door. Will any other man stop and talk? But not the walking man. Walk on, walking man. Well, now, would he have wings to fly? Yeah.
45 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon here on KTUO FM in Juno, KRNN FM in Juno. In the studio with me now is Ashley Rowland and Daniel Kirk, two of the members of Body Box, who is performing tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the high school auditorium. I should say the Juno Douglas High School auditorium. Thank you for coming down the station today.
Thank you for having us.
So I've seen it online. I've seen the posters. You need to tell the public out there, what is Body Box?
Well, Body Box is a contemporary dance company. We're based in Portland, Oregon. And we're just finishing up our 17th season, and we have produced several shows, full-length shows, about a dozen short films, three operas, some videos, and we've toured all over the world.
How did we get started?
My name is Ashley Rowland, and I'm one of the artistic directors, along with my husband. We were out of New York City with a company called ISO. ISO's roots were sort of based out of the company called Palabolas, a very avant-garde company. So after ISO, we decided that maybe we ought to try a different city. New York City had become quite crowded with dance companies. My husband's originally from Portland, so we tried Portland, moved out there, got involved, found a great community of dancers, and started this crazy adventure.
How many people are in it?
Body Box is about 9 dancers right now. In this particular production we brought here is only 6 dancers.
Where did the name come about?
Okay. The name Body Box, VOX is the last part of the name. So Body Box for us was trying to find a name that encapsulated what we like to do. We like to tell stories with dance. We like to incorporate all different kinds of movement, not just dance techniques. Our work is very eclectic and accessible and non-categorical. So we needed a term that kind of encapsulated all of that. So we used body, and we thought we wanted to represent the body talking. So we came up with body vox. Vox means voice in Latin.
I saw some of your work on the internet, and a lot of what you seem to do is create people sculptures.
Ah, yeah. We do create a lot of imagery, I would say, and our work tends to be athletic and humorous, and then on top of that, we knit together our shows like one particular journey, and to sort of interrupt energy throughout the course of the evening, we intersperse short films. And those short films are also us in dance form, but they're a la kind of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin-esque, and very entertaining. And they give the audience a break, and they give us a break to change costumes, and makes the evening very tasty.
Costumes. You want to talk about those for a little bit?
Sure. Costumes. What do you think, Daniel? Costumes.
Well, I think you're the one to talk about it. You design them.
Yes. We wear everything. And I think in this particular show you're going to see some very beautiful costumes. One of the signature piece, which is called Reverie, the show is called Reverie, is performed to the Lakme flower duet, the operatic beautiful flower duet. And so the costumes are in fact flowers, but uniquely built so that when you turn the women upside down is when the actual flower blossom is represented. And the men are sort of these bamboo stalks. And this piece takes place in the garden, like a imagistic, painting from Monet or something like that.
Tell me about the creative process. Is it group-driven or is it individually driven?
My husband and I choreograph most of the work. Daniel, as well as another dancer, Eric Skinner, also have choreographed some pieces. And there is one piece of theirs on this performance, which is on a trapeze, which is really exciting, called X-Axis. Most of the time, my husband and I collaborate together and choreograph, and we do the artistic directorship of the whole curating of the show.
What comes first, the choreography or the music?
Yeah, really. I think the chicken does. I have no idea. There's no answer for that. really, there's no perfect formula. I think the impulse will come in any form. It'll either be you'll get the idea for a particular movement or a particular costume, or you'll hear a great piece of music, and you know, or sometimes it's a story. There are so many different ways to approach it, and I don't think that any way is the right way. They're all right. They just happen.
We use them all.
Yeah.
Just depends from piece to piece.
Yeah. There's a lot of craziness in the studio.
Influences.
Influences. That's a tough question. Okay. Well, let's say. Like I said, my husband worked with Palabolas. The two of us spun off and worked in a group called Momix. So I will say that Palabolas, at its core, is a very inventive company, and their work is different than any other technical dance company out there. It's very sculptural. And they tend to bring in theater and beauty. Those are very true to us, too. We live in that same family tree. Beauty, theater, story, and movement all sort of wrapped together. I think where we sort of drift away from Palabolas is our work is a little more kinetic, and it's much more, well, I shouldn't say athletic, but it has a much more diverse scope in dance than Palabolas, which is mostly sculptural.
When you talk about telling a story through your dancing, is it something that you clue the audience in on, or do you expect them to come up with the story itself?
Again, I think it depends on the piece. It differs from piece to piece. Some of the works that we do have a very clear storyline, and I think that everybody would sort of experience the same story. And then there are other pieces that either when they were created, they didn't have a story. They were created just as dance pieces, but kind of find a story later on in their life. Or sometimes we have a story, but the audience may experience a completely different story.
And I think also the word story is maybe a little vague, because it's not like we're doing a coppelia where there is a real libretto to the story. When I say story, I think that the audience will identify in particular character and dramatic intent, and they will have a certain reaction based on that, and they will be washed over with a certain emotion. So then filling in the lines of what actually happened is kind of up to the audience.
When I saw your video online, some of the costumes, you could definitely tell it's a person with the costume on, but some of the costumes, are you wondering how there's a person inside the costume?
I'm not really sure I know what you're talking about in particular, but thank you. Yeah.
What can we expect on Saturday night?
You can expect to see a dance company like you've never seen before. This is a great dance company to come out and see if you don't know what dance is or if you're afraid of dance, because Bodyvox is incredibly accessible. We never alienate our audience. We don't leave them with an abstract feeling. It certainly is a very entertaining and lovely evening. This show in particular is just dripping with beauty and beautiful imagery. And fabulous music and wonderful dancers. So it's a full package, and something I would say anybody could watch it. Children to the elderly will all enjoy it. It doesn't really have any barriers.
Well, it's certainly fascinating to watch.
Can we say one thing, too? We learned that if you buy tickets to this and the Dance Machine, which I believe are on the same night, but there's also a Dance Machine on Sunday, you can get $2 off the ticket to our show.
To Body Fox.
Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you buy both, $2 off for Body Fox.
Thank you very much for doing that. Thank you for coming to Juneau.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. I've been talking with Ashley Rowland and Daniel Kirk, who are performing tomorrow as part of the Body Box group. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Свои глаза, танго, обними меня покрепче. Мы с тобой танцуем до утра. С аргентинской страсти бесконечной завлекали звуки скрипки нас, обещая горы наслаждения. Не забыть мне этот чудный глаз. Этот танго милая для вас медленно движется пара за парой танцем влекомые чувством сраженные
It's about 4 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned in to KRNN FM in Juneau and KTO News in Juneau. In studio with me now is Scott Burton, who's got a great show lined up for tonight. People come down to the station.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff, so much. Thanks for having me on the show today. Writer Showcase tonight, 7 p.m. at 360 downstairs. Admission is free. We have some great writers that are participating. Mariah Warren, Kevin Myers. People may remember Kevin. Who used to live here in Juneau, now lives in Portland. Bobby McCutcheon, who folks may know as part of Wearable Art Community. She'll be one of the writers. Asha Falcon. And then our four performers include Christina Apathy, Quint Farr, Roblin Gray Davis, and Elizabeth Davis. So a star-studded cast, Jeff. We're really excited.
Is there a theme this time?
It is. It's journeys. So there's a few compasses. There are many trips, both literal and metaphorical, in tonight's show. Some false expectations, some love. Some really great stories.
And I heard Mars being mentioned.
Yeah, we're going to have a sci-fi piece tonight, Bobby McCutcheon's piece called The Broken Journey. Roblin Gray Davis will be reading that. It's a imagery-filled piece, a sunset stroll against time on Mars. Da-da-da.
When can people see this?
So it's 7 o'clock tonight. Admission is free. We roll cameras sharp, so you'll be part of the live television broadcast tonight. We love having people there responding to the stories, laughing, crying, applauding, hooting, whatever, having fun. And then it will be broadcast for the first time the following Thursday on 360 North. At 8 p.m., but it will be up on YouTube early next week as well on our 360 North playlist. So I hope people go and check that out. And I hope they come tonight, 7 o'clock. Admission is free.
They should get there earlier than 7.
They should. Seats start to fill up around 6:30. And for the better seats, come early. And then we close the doors at 7 because it's a TV broadcast.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Weather forecast for tonight, rain, low temperatures 32 to 38 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, rain showers likely with high temperatures around 43 degrees. Sunday, mostly cloudy skies. Sunday night, mostly clear skies, low temperatures 27 to 35 degrees. Coming up Monday and on June afternoon, Scott Burton will be your host. We'll learn about communicable diseases. Stu Roberts will be here with details about the boating safety checks of the Coast Guard. And Maude Morris will be here to highlight tomorrow Monday night's class for home buyers.
This is KTO.